I'm not sure.
Right, I think that probably is recording now. The red light's on. So if we stick it down there, and it should be able to pick you up. Yes, I think. Are we still recording there? Definitely. Yes, we're still recording there. Definitely. So hopefully it should also be able to pick me up at this distance if necessary. But it should pick your voice up okay. So if we started off with what you remember from being in hospital when you were little, because I know you've told me about being in the cottage hospital. So how old were you when you went into the cottage?
Just 4, I think.
So that would be 1931.
Well, it was either, I was either 3 or 4, I can't honestly say. I know March came into us somewhere. Whether that was when I went in or when I came out, I don't know. But I was there for 6 weeks. And they still have the same seating.
Oh, in that hall, yeah. Like a bench.
Yeah, that was there then, and it's still in good condition. My parents weren't allowed to visit me. They thought it might upset me seeing them and going away again. And I had my operation, which was quite spectacular for the Isle of Man, really. My new Dr. Panton was a very clever man. But it was the first time that it had been done in the Isle of Man on somebody as young as that. I had a mastoid operation. And of course, in those days, it meant them trepanning your skull to get into the place they didn't. Nowadays, I think they pull the ear forward and work behind it. But I was in a lot of discomfort and pain before I went in there, but I don't remember having any pain or anything afterwards. And Matron Proctor had a reputation for being very strict and starchy, but I found her wonderful. And because I was able to get up and run round after a time, I had the run of the place. And also, they were decorating at the time, so I would be upstairs in her quarters, in the ward, all over the place with the decorators. I thought that was great fun. And then they had, of course, the big garden in the front there, then where the surgery is now.
Oh,
aye. And I used to go with the gardener and pot around the garden with him. I had a really sort of enjoyable time, really. Eric used to come up on his bike, park the bike, the wall on the outside on Barron Road was a high wall because the garden was a lot higher than the outside. And there were little steps you could sort of get up. So he used to come on his bike and climb up these little steps. And I was able to talk to him. He'd be outside and I was inside, sort of thing. And there were things that I wanted or we thought that I wanted, he should bring up for me.
So Uncle Eric must have been 14, 13, 14.
And I quite enjoyed myself there. I got some of the nurses into trouble because a lot of the nurses used to come down to George and Phyllis, who lived next door, and on their off duty and have a cup of coffee or whatnot, you know. And if they were, somebody would say, oh, so-and-so's a bit laid back, you know. Oh, they'll be down at George Griffiths's drinking coffee. But altogether, it was a very efficiently run hospital. But it was, they had great fun when the matron went out. She used to go to Peel a lot, watch the sunset. And when she went off down the hill in her car, the gramophone came out in the men's ward and they would have a dance. Somebody would be posted to keep looking down the road so that when they saw a car appearing, it all got jammed back in the cupboard again. Because in those days, of course, the wards all had a big range of cupboards down the middle where they kept loads of equipment and stuff and on the ground floor. I've known the Cottage Hospital now for more than 84 years.
I remember you telling me about some... Was there other children in when you were in?
There was a boy from the home. And I forget what happened to what was it? I think he fell and badly damaged his knee. And he was... It wasn't getting any better, it was getting worse, whatever it was. And in the end, he died. But I can't remember any other children, but that boy really stuck in my mind. He got it, he must have been infected or something, you know, and it affected the bone as well as the flesh. And, he died. I don't remember. Oh, Bobby Dugdale was one of the men in the men's ward. I remember him, but can't remember any of the others that were in there. And didn't have an awful lot to do with the women's ward. There wasn't much fun in there. but the nurses. I can still picture some of them, even now, if I concentrate on it, you know. I don't think, they weren't all fully qualified in those days.
No, they wouldn't have been.
There was an Irish girl, she was fully qualified, and a couple of the others were, but there were two or three of them who were sort of would be regarded perhaps SENs later on. They weren't classified in those days. But when I remember going, first time I'd ever been in a taxi, Willie Dawson picked us up, mother and I, and took us up there. And when we opened the door and went in, and the matron was waiting inside the door with the nurse hovering around. And she said, right, Mr. Dawson. So he took me from mother, passed me over to this nurse, who immediately whisked me down the corridor and out of sight while they filled in the forms and whatnot, you know. But it was all very quick. There was no tearful goodbyes or whatnot.
Started school not long after that.
I should have started school at the Christmas term, the following year, when I would be five. But because I was still having to go back and forward to the hospital for checkups and whatnot, they left me off, and I didn't start school until, I don't know, was it the Easter or the summer term? But I know I was allowed some time that I didn't go. But there again, it was a right sort of happy time. I don't remember anything miserable happening at school until I was about maybe 10, and there was a girl called Dorothy Moore, and there was sort of the attempts to get into clans, you know, and her clan didn't agree with our clan, and then we were waiting to go back into school after playtime, standing in line, and she said something and turned round and scratched my hand, and left every nail left it bleeding. So we were carted up to Mr. Fletcher in the hall, and she got whacked over the knuckles, and I didn't get much sympathy, but at least he did give me a hanky to wrap round it.
That was good of him.
So I was bleeding all over the place, and told me I could go to the school nurse the next day, that you had to go down Christian Street where the bank is, where the pay in the wall thing is. You used to go upstairs there to the nurse's place. She didn't come to school, you went to her. But I had the marks on my hand. In fact, on a cold day, you can still see them faintly, white, little white rills going down. She made a good job of it.
When I was at school, the school nurse was in them buildings on the other side of the playground where the kitchen was.
Oh.
Didn't you do domestic, didn't they have domestic science?
Domestic
we
science.
Didn't have domestic science when I was at Albert Road.
Domestic science to the right and woodwork to the left when you went in there. The boys went to woodwork and the girls went to domestic science.
So was there a kitchen to cook meals there as well then?
Well, the kitchen was sort of, when you went in, there was a place where there was a pantry. And then that narrower part of the room where the entrance the pantry, there were cookers along there, and that's where you cooked. But you did your getting, preparing and doing just at the desks around. They also did laundry there. You had to bring a piece of laundry. And while your cake or whatever was in the oven, you did your bit of laundry and put it on a rail. And if you didn't bring any, you were in trouble.
I think I could have done without laundry lessons at school.
But I didn't go to the grammar school because with being off, because again I had another almost 6 months off with the ear trouble again when I was eight, and I never sort of caught up really, and I didn't want to go to grammar school anyway because I knew damn fine that you had to have so much gear, and I thought my parents couldn't afford it, so I didn't really try. I was happy at Albert Road, and they must have taught us rather well because I've never felt that I was any the less for it. Eric also went to Albert Road. He left at 14 and went into an apprenticeship. And I left at 14 and became a domestic help, I suppose you would call it. But
well, the war would already be on by then, wouldn't it? If you left it,
yes.
If you were born in 27, that must have been 1941.
Yeah. Again, I left at Christmas because my birthday was in January, and I was allowed to leave at the Christmas term. I finished school on the Friday and started work on the Monday. But there again, the war did reflect on us when we were still at school, but not as much. Somehow.
Did you have to knit?
Oh yes, well we knitted for the army.
I read about that.
And made things. They used to make housewives for the soldiers. You know, they were made of, I don't know, linen, some strong material. Then inside they had little sections made of felt, and they were stitched to the outside down the middle, and therefore they had places to put their needles and cotton and whatnot, and it all tied off with a bow at one side, and they could carry that with them wherever they went to do the essential mending.
So you were basically making those in your domestic science lessons?
No, that was separate.
Oh, right. Separate slot for it.
We did that. I suppose it must have been instead of some other lesson. But we did that in the classroom. And also, of course, we learned to sew.
Yes, that would be a good lesson to sew.
You had sewing lessons. Learned to use a sewing machine. Mind, there was always a queue for the sewing machines. There weren't enough to go around. But we learned how to use a pattern and how to sew it up. And, you know, the education then was much more practical, sensible. But of course, by the time I was about 15, well, we had sole disabilities with us. So we always had four soldiers. And then I was allowed, so long as one of them undertook to look after me, I was allowed to go to dances. And we used to go to the pool. And quite often, you used to have dances at least twice a week, probably more. But the ordinary dance finished at 11 o'clock. No messing. And then the late dance on a Friday night, that we went on till 11:45. So that gave you time to get home before the 12 o'clock. And then, of course, by the time I was 16, we would be going to the dances at the Sergeant Mess.
Sorry, Jerby?
At Jerby, first of all, and then later Andrews too. And they were always good dudes. Harry Crandall used to put a coach on, and you got the coach and took you to the dance. And then they picked you up again and brought you home. They were good times. And we used to date the various airmen and whatnot. And you'd make a date to meet one at 6:30 outside the plaza, and then another one at 7 o'clock outside the cinema house. And so if you didn't fancy the fellow at 6:30, you missed him and went on and went to the pictures with the fellow
at 7 o'clock.
At 7 o'clock. No. You know, never any shortage of choice when it came to boys.
So were most of them the RAF?
Yeah.
How did you have soldiers billeted with you?
Well, when they when they took over for the internment camp, they had to put the men somewhere. So they, I don't know, they asked for volunteers or did they just commandeer you? But a couple of officers and the sergeant major came round, inspected the premises, and then decided how many you could be allocated for you. And we were the only people in our area. A lot of them were on the South Prom because the big houses there had more rooms, you know. But all the lads we had, I don't remember there being any bother with any of them. Except for Tom. He was a sergeant. Can't just think of his surname now. And his wife and family were in Peel because he brought them over. He'd been stationed at Peel Camp. And then he was transferred to Ramsey Camp, but they stayed in Peel. and he got himself a girlfriend. So he was always getting told off because he wouldn't be home. He had to be supposed to be, the door was supposed to be locked at midnight. And Tom frequently didn't arrive home till about 4 o'clock in the morning, you know. And so mother and father were always peppering to him. But altogether, through the war, I think it was 37 different chaps who were businesses with us. And of course, food was a bit tight. And you got more for keeping a horse than you got for keeping a man. The daily allocation, you know. And so it was a bit hard to make ends meet sometimes. But we had the allotment up at the top, at the Cruikshanks Corner.
Oh, I know, yeah.
That was a big garden. And so we used to grow quite a bit of stuff. That we, never any shortage of potatoes, because we got them from the farm. My father used to go and help them to lift the crop, and then he got so many bags and he brought them down. So we always had spuds, and we used to grow our own onions. So my mother would make a big pot of onion gravy, mm-hmm. and another big pot of potatoes, mashed potatoes, and put them where the little oval shaped dishes that we used to call the pig troughs, and she'd put mashed potato in it, and then pour thick onion gravy over the top, and wrap it up in a tea towel, and you had to take that over the swing bridge. And there was a gate into the internment camp at the swing bridge, mm-hmm. and somebody would be on guard there. So you had to take that over and pass it on to whichever of our lads happened to be on guard, and they had a good feel of good.
Mash and onion gravy.
Yeah. I mean, that was all it was, but they really enjoyed it, you know. The gravy would be made with good beef dripping and a bit tasty, like. Mm. We used to have, there was a sergeant, I don't know what his real name was, we always called him a Spitfire. One of the old school, he'd been in the First World War, you know, and Spitty used to always get things wrong. He's always getting things mixed up. On one occasion, he yelled into the guard room that the CO was coming, and they all sort of spruced up, you know, already waiting for the man. When it arrived, it was called a spread van drawn by a horse. And how he got mixed up between the gate in North Shore Road and the guard room, which was in one of the bungalows by the entrance to the park. But they're all there standing ready at attention, you know. And the baker arrived. And then the fellow, we used to call him Black something, scruffy individual. And the internees used to be allowed to go to the cinema once a week, to the cinema house. And so you wrote in the book at the gate who came in, who went out, you know. And this chap was on guard at the gate, and instead of writing down that he had these so many men had gone to the cinema, he put it down that they'd gone to the Crimea. Which was a little disconcerting. But the internees worked on the farms.
Yeah.
And it was rather funny, really, because most of them went to work on the bus. There'd be two or three internees and one guard. And then they went on the normal bus. Because the one, there were two or three used to work on the farmers down at the Crenshaw. And they always went by bus. But there was one chap, very, very smart, always wore leggings and breeches, and it was all really, really neat. And he was not very popular with the other fellows somehow. I think he must have been a person of some order in Sevy Street. And there would be three of them going down to Ballymore, and the other two would be laughing and joking and, you know, clouting on, but this fellow was always very stiff and always walked on his own, sort of thing. But they said he was awfully good on the farm, that he was a very good worker. And they had two at Ballygenny. One was an Albanian, but Italy took over Albania, and his family were taken to Italy to work. And he was Angelo. And then the other one came from Trieste was an open city then. It didn't really sort of belong to anybody. And he came from Trieste. But they were both seamen, and the boat they were on, of course, when war was declared, it came into the nearest port as directed, and the nearest port was in England. So they ended up being interned, although neither of them had any real interest in the war. You know, they weren't. Angelo was very worried because his mother and his sister were in Italy, and they were having a bad time of it when we invaded Italy, and there was a lot of fighting near where they were, and he didn't know whether they were alive or dead.
How did he know where they were?
Well, I think they communicated by letter, the Red Cross and whatnot.
Oh, right.
Kept them in touch. And did Tony have any parents or family, or he never mentioned them, but it was them who made me that boat in a bottle when they were getting released. And Tony made me that little
yacht,
little boat, as a going away present. But they were awfully nice lads, and no harm in them at all. They weren't in any way enemies, you know. Some of them were really nasty. The Quislings, they were a rotten lot. There's some Finns, and they were kept in a separate bit of the camp. They wired off a bit to keep them apart, but there was trouble with them. They had a couple of wounds and things, but nothing drastic, but they weren't at all amenable. And I often wonder, Tom Conti was here looking for his father, where his father had been interned, and I suppose Conti is quite a common Italian name, but we had a Conti in the camp, a rather eccentric man who used to be allowed to go out on the beach and gather pebbles. The soldier would have to go with him trailing around while he and he made things out of these pebbles. Also, he would save his bread ration and mash it up and then let it sort of half set, and make models out of it, like little statues and things. But he was often in the guardhouse for various misdemeanors. And in the spring, when as soon as the weather started to get warm, he cut the legs out of his trousers to knee thing. And then when the weather got cold again, he would have to stitch them back on again. And so, of course, his pants kept getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Shorter through the years. He was a real character. But they used to have weekly dances at the various sergeant's messes. At Jerby, it was well laid out. It was a proper camp, you know. Mm-hmm. And where the that cafe thing is now,
the guardhouse.
If you were looking across the road, the parade ground would be immediately in front of you on the other side. And behind that was the officers' mess, which then became the pub later on. But the sergeant's mess was sort of round the corner a bit. But we used to have great fun there. There was always great, they would have snacks. The cooks would make various snacks out of whatever they could scrounge, you know, and they would have that. Of course, there's always drink to be had, but they used to invite people. You'd see a notice on the police station wall, for instance, saying that a dance would be held, and all people were invited to go. But Andreas was not a permanent airport. It was it came later. But when they were building Jerby in 1937-38, one of the chaps who drove a great big digger thing lodged with us, Welsh lad, and he used to go to work cleaning in the morning, and he used to come back absolutely covered in red dust because the soil out there was very reddish, you know, with driving this thing, the wind would blow on him, and his clothing, his hair, everything would be painted red by the time he came back. Mother was forever washing things to keep him sort of decent. And he used to confuse my father because he never talked about a horse and cart like we did. He always talked about a cart and horse. And my father used to say, that's not right. The horse goes before the cart. But apparently, whether he was having my dad on or not, I don't know. But he used to say, well, where I live, it's very, very hilly, very mountainous area. And the horses push the carts up the hill, you know. It was easier to do it that way.
So they have cart and horse.
Yeah. So we always talk about a cart and horse. Whether it was true or not, I don't know.
Well, over at Balagenny, was grandfather still alive then?
Grandfather died in 1941.
So there'd be Uncle Charlie.
Uncle Tom.
So Uncle Charlie must have been reserved because he was the main farmer, because he'd only been 40-ish? I suppose that's a bit... he was never called up because he'd be too old.
Well, he was born in the 1900. And
so he wouldn't have been called up because he would be reserved. And then Tom wasn't well, was he? So
no,
Tom's
heart was
so
bad.
He was older.
Yeah.
But they must have been glad of the two internees.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And they fitted in very well. They were like part of the family, you know what I mean? They came in the they always had a soldier with them, but they worked really hard. And Jack Langdon, who was billeted with us, a Cornishman, his job usually was going around from one farm to the other every day on a motorbike to check that everything was well, you know, because he didn't have mobile phones or rubbish then. Hardly anybody on farms had phones. Mm-hmm. So he used to go around, you know, and check that that nobody's escaped.
I suppose they'd have got far.
And then Gwenny Cruz, Gwenny Clary, who later lived out here, well, she farmed in Sulby.
Mm-hmm.
And it was her that was a farmer. Her husband was a slaughterman at the abattoir, but Gwenny did the farming. And she had two internees. And they borrowed a bull off another farm. And he was the daftest thing that you ever came across. He used to come to the back door and knock with his horns on the back door. And when Granny would open the door, she usually gave him a bit of bread or something. But he had sore feet. And they kept a little tin bath hanging on the wall outside the back door. And when he wanted his feet washed, he used to knock this down off the wall with his horns and wait for it to put water in so he could bathe his feet. But the two internees were terrified of him. The idea of a bull, oh, that was something ferocious, you know. And he knew it, and he used to play up, and you'd see them coming on the street, you know, sort of looking around about, see where he was. He was always roaming round, and if he was within sight, they sort of went round by the wall, you know, and he'd be watching them, and then all of a sudden he'd let a roar out of them and charge across, and they would run like the dickens and hide in a pigsty or somewhere, you know. But he had to go back when they decided that he'd been there long enough. And the men that came to take him back to the other farm, of course they had to go along the road, and they arrived with pitchforks. And Gwenny, oh my God, she hit the roof. Oh, they said, you've got to have these, you've got to keep proving them to keep going. Indeed you won't, she said. Anyway, she walked from Sulby, that was just below Sulby Bridge Station.
Mm-hmm.
And she walked through to St. Jude's, to the other farm, and she broke one of the pitchforks. She was arguing with the bloke who had it, and I don't know if she put it over her knee or what she did, but she broke it anyway. But she never let them touch her. And she walked. She held one of his horns to steer him where he was going. And here the three of them, these two big men, all armed to the teeth sort of thing, you know. And here's this little woman, because, I mean, she was only thin, skinny little bit, walking this bull home as if he'd been a dog on a lead, you know. But they got there all right. But she never forgave them, if you dare touch that bull. She used to ask people after he went back to see how he was getting on, you know, was he all right? But he was the daftest animal you would ever come across, you know. And if she wasn't quick enough to give me the bread outside the back door, he would arrive in the back kitchen, which meant that then he had to be backed out because he couldn't turn round in there. I mean, they were right near the road. There was only one way in, the gate going in, on the farm street, and he'd be wandering around all over the place, but he never went anywhere near the road. I never remember him getting into any trouble in that direction. Mind you, he used to knock people's hedges down and generally behaved like a badly behaved teenager, you know what I mean? But it was good fun.
Did you have cattle on Ballygenny as well?
Oh, yeah. Tom was in charge of the sheep. Charlie was in charge of the cattle. But grandfather, by that time, he was getting, I mean, he was 83 when he died. And he used to walk down the road to the well. We can't see it now, it's all grown over. But there was a sort of semicircular thing in the road where the well was. And there were three big tubs, the insides of wash boilers,
mm-hmm.
you know, big metal tubs sunk into the ground. And then grandfather used to see to get them filled up before the cattle came up. And the cattle always stayed there to drink, get a good drink before going home.
So what happened to the milk?
Oh, it was, wasn't it, what was it? It used to come, a wagon of some kind used to come round and collect any milk that you had surplus. And a certain amount was separated every day, went through the separator, and you kept the cream, and then you fed the skim milk to the calves or whatnot, and then once a week you made your butter with the cream you'd saved. And then there was a butcher from Douglas, and they used to come once a week, and they used to collect eggs. If you had extra eggs, you kept them for them. And any butter you had extra.
So were you allowed to keep as much as you wanted for yourself, or were you kind of, or would the farm be rationed as well?
Well, you weren't officially supposed to, but there wasn't, things weren't as strict over here. Mind you, there was one rather complicated thing. If you kept a pig, you sent it for slaughter, and you got half of it back. Mm-hmm. They kept half, and then you could do what you liked with that. You could either put it in brine and turn it into bacon, or cook it ready, you know. But I remember a fellow used to work on the buses, and it was great agitation, and I must get home, must get home, I must get home. I can't work. This will be my last trip. I must get home. Why? What's the matter, Rupert? Well, I'm killing half a pig this afternoon. The man's coming. Kill half a pig.
I remember you talking the other week about the quadrants for the things. And so if we finish off by going back over that bit, because I think that's one of the bits Matthew wanted to know about.
Well, they had observation posts, proper ones down the point. They had the waffery, you know, point that, and all the buildings along the side of the road. A lot of them were sort of radar, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
They were top secret anyway. And then at the point and all along the coast, there were these wooden, they looked like they were the bases for windmills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were sort of octagonal shaped on legs.
Yeah.
And there was one at Ballygenny, there was one at the Hidden Valley, Smale.
Where was the Hidden Valley?
Oh, it's between Balaghenny and Cranstall.
Oh, right.
And you know where Laura, where their house was?
Yeah.
You went down that, down Blerman Road to the shore. And this airmen on those, when they were doing, they had it out in the sea, they had big, like, rafts.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones who were coming over for bombing practice, the men in the quadrants were, they had to observe whether the bombs landed safely or how far out they were, you know, they had to maintain to teach the pilots, help them with their bombing. And then, of course, at Derby, they they had the train in the field going out towards Derby West. There was this concrete wall, large semicircular concrete wall, and there were various fitments on the land side of it, and on the sea side of it there was a rail track.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a wee engine with a Spitfire on the top. And the wee engine went along the track. You could see the plane over the top of the wall, but you couldn't see the engine. And then they had to fire at this plane. They'd be in dugouts and whatnot. And they had to fire at the plane as it went past. And then the whole thing turned around somehow and went back again. But the track for that was still there. I don't know, it might still be there for all I know. But it was there for years and years and years after the war. And of course, down south, they also had army because it was supposed to be guarding the women internees. But they didn't have much to do down there. They had women, police women, that sort of were in contact with them. Actually, the people who were down there thought it was marvellous because there was no bombing. There was more food than they got on the mainland. And they were looked after really well, you know. Spent most of their time in the summer on the shore. And a lot of them were quite sorry when they got shipped back again. But then you had the Navy at Ronald's Way. That was the Naval Air Station.
Oh, well, that would be Navy.
And then, of course, in Douglas, they had the St. George, the Navy Training School, and the two airports up here, and the various soldiers who were guarding the internees and whatnot. They did also sometimes send people over here who had had a very rough time of it, and they just sent them more or less recuperate. We once had a bomb disposal officer, Willie Spraggan. And we weren't supposed to have officers billeted with the men, of course, but he insisted that he didn't want to go with the officers, he wanted to go with the men. So we had him for about a month, and he had been working on unexploded bombs, you know, that in the cities. And he was in quite a bad way when he came, but a month of rest, it did him the world of good. He was a different man when he went. Altogether, I mean, I know it was a bad time. My mother was always terrified in case anything happened to Eric. And when it was Dunkirk, there was no message came from, no message. And they announced on the radio that all that could be evacuated had been evacuated, and any that were left behind would be prisoners of war. And she was really, really uptight about it. And then about 2 hours afterwards, the telegraph boy came. And again, she was terrified. She didn't want to open the telegram. And he said, "It's all right, Mrs. Howland. I read it when they were typing it. You know, it was coming through. It's all right." But what was on the telegram, it said, "I'm safe and well. But it's ended up your son. No name." And that worried her too. She said, "Oh God, he must be hurt, he must be wounded. Couldn't, you know." But apparently, as the trains came through